Exactly as to what you were saying was true. I didn't realize that this at the time, but if you want to be, you have to pay for and find and seek out an editor yourself now, basically, before you go to a literary agent or to a publisher. That is something that the writer has to take upon themselves. They want a fully edited novel that's basically turnkey ready. Because even back then in the day, just the money was just drying up in publishing. Yeah.
Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of Media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P. Here, as always, my guest today is Arvind. How are we doing today, Arvind?
Well, great. How are you doing?
I am getting to talk to a creator on a Friday for me, so it's a good day.
All right.
Why don't you, we'll start things off like I like to. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, where you come from, and how you ended up in this place?
Yeah, I was hoping you could tell me. I have no idea. I have none whatsoever.
I'm glad you made it, because I was just about to make a joke, and the answer can't be because I clubbed you and drugged you
and
carried you in.
Okay, so the truth is out. So I'll just make up something then. It was after college. I was going to be in a band, and because sort of like it didn't stop me. I should have a shock collar on me. I'll give you the non-annotated version. But I really wanted to do music in college, and I got kicked out of a band, and it was sort of traumatic. And I took up with a new group of friends, and they were all into comic books, and I had always loved comic books, and so it was our last year of college, and we said we could start a comic book club, and we could get a comic printed, and we could use all of their production facilities. This is in like the G3 era of the Macintoshes, and they just got these brand spanking new sparkly G3s for the all the student publications. We were just like, well, we could do that. So it was one of the happiest times of my life. I mean, we just stay up until 3 a.m. drinking. Remember those like 99-cent Arizona tea, green tea things? They were like this big.
Yeah, they still are, surprisingly. I don't know how he's keeping costs down.
Are they really? Man, capitalism, man. And what a beautiful thing. What a beautiful thing.
There's also a wonderful song about those called $1 Can.
Okay, yeah. So we would just stay up until 3 a.m. drinking, you know, those monster Arizona tea cans and like eating like, you know, Bugles, like Bugle corn snacks. And it was just, you know, like one night, kind of towards the end of school, graduation was coming up, and one of our crew, Billy, said, you know, we could do this after school too. We could all move to Brooklyn and we could start our own comic book publishing empire. And that's what we did. I mean, we did, you know, the whole comic, the publishing empire. I don't know if that worked out, but that's exactly what.
You're still working on the publishing empire. You haven't got there yet.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's kind of in a nutshell. That's kind of how I got started writing comics. Yeah.
Okay. And along the way, what are some of, I guess, the highlights or the high points and maybe low points if you want to go there?
Yeah. Oh, there have been low points. Actually, I don't mind going into low points. Like once, so I wrote a comic called Rex Mundi. I was after school, and I was also interested in film at the time. And I realized pretty quickly, like, wow, I do not want to work in the film industry. It's intense and it's brutal. I was working on a Woody Allen movie right after college for summer as a production assistant, which is like intense. It was all on location shooting in New York City. And like, I was a locations PA, which means you have to lock down the set. That means that while they're filming on, you know, they have a legal right to film on a block of New York City, and pedestrians are not allowed to walk. So I was a person to tell cantankerous New York City pedestrians that they could not walk down the street that they wanted to walk on. So yeah, there were like three death. I was like, oh, it was just a 2 death threat day today. That wasn't too bad. So yeah, so that was intense. Where was I going with that? Yeah, film. So I had this idea for a comic, Rex Mundi. I kind of was another production assistant for another movie. It was like a documentary in Paris. And I was just stuck with the bags. I was a production assistant. So they went into all these beautiful places in Paris to film, like Saint-Sulpice or Notre Dame or like Saint-Germain-des-Prés. Anyway, all these beautiful places. I got to see none of them because I was outside like a jerk, you know, like with the bags, like a complete... like a complete moron. But, you know, I was just standing there in the street kind of like thinking, wow, it must be really great inside there. And that's kind of how Rex Mundi was born. But just, this is one of like the low points. Flash forward, we submitted Rex Mundi to Image Comics and there was some back and forth. And it kind of came to a head at the Chicago Wizard World Convention in 2001 or 2000. If I'm not mistaken. At any rate, someone from Image Comics came by our booth and said, after all of this like heartache and storm, and like all of our hopes and dreams and fears and anxieties we're riding on Image, came by and said, I'm sorry, it's not going to work. I don't think this is a good fit for Image Comics. And it was after we thought we were going to be, I don't know, wires got crossed a little bit, but we were under the impression that they were going to publish us. I had a total nervous breakdown in the, airport. I just started because I missed my flight too. It was just like I just didn't need to miss my flight. So I was just like weeping hysterically in the Chicago O'Hare International Airport at like 3 in the morning. There was like the Zamboni guy, like, you know, polishing the floor, which is me and him, just like I'm like curled up in a fetal position. He's like, so yeah, that was kind of a low point. I lost all my hair. I lost all my hair publishing Rex Mundi.
I just kind of assumed that you didn't have hair at that point. You're one of those guys who realized early, you know, I'm just going to do this.
Yeah, no, I lost it that night, and you know, it was a happy ending. We did end up getting published by Image, and I'm, you know, forever grateful for them. But I lost all. I used to have a glorious full head of hair. And then I decided to start publishing comics.
Now, has that been the general barometer ever since, out of curiosity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I love it. I think it's intense. There's been a lot of ups and downs in my career. A lot of people say that. Here's what I have found. I know that we're talking about marketing, which I really appreciate because I appreciate what you do. I think marketing is extremely important. I think what I've noticed for myself is that good things have happened in my career when I do things of my own initiative, on my own. So that's where I'm at right now. I am going back to self-publishing. And I have more control over the marketing aspect also, which is extremely, extremely, extremely important.
Well, it's... When the pressure's on you and the bill's on you, it's a much easier calculation, I think, for people. The minute you start throwing other cooks into the kitchen, other people that have their own bag that they need to grab, the math just starts getting complicated. And I don't think it ever really works out in anyone's favor with math is that complicated.
Yeah, it doesn't work out. It's never worked out in my favor. I mean, it works out for someone, I guess. You know, and we'll talk. I think we'll get into this later in the show, or you know, now, whenever you want. But I can definitely talk about some marketing things that have worked for me and some marketing things that have not worked for me. And it's exactly what you're saying. That what you just said really resonates with me. A lot of cooks in the kitchen, basically.
What I'd actually like to start with is Rex Mundi. That was a big part of, you know, your comic work writing career. Where are we at now? What are you currently working on? I could say that I've seen parts of it, and frankly, what I saw blew my mind. I just loved it. Is that we're still working on that, or where are we at?
Yeah, Thank you. First of all, thank you. Yeah. I'm really, really, really blessed. Oh, God, I don't even know where to start. Okay. I'm going to go with like another long worn piece. Kind of origin story on The Band of the Crow. That's what it's called. It's called The Band of the Crow, and it's a fantasy novel. It's fantasy. Through Rex Mundi, I got really interested in Indo-Europe. There's this religion called Mithraism. I don't know. I just got very interested in pre-Christian traditions and how they impacted Christianity. So I got very interested in Indo-European linguistics and sort of proto-culture. For instance, this blew me away. Hindi and English are in the same language family.
What's funny is that a lot of the things that you think are related language-wise aren't, even though they have, like, the number of click languages that there are, as they're called, and where you find them, and have, like, these people have never met each other very clearly, but somehow languages developed independently, or... I'm a big John McWhorter fan, so I've done a little study in language.
Yes, John McWhorter, he's brilliant. He's fearless. John McWhorter's a very interesting guy. Very, and like a legit linguist, which, you know, I'm not. I'm a total amateur. But this is one of my favorite stories. There's a healing prayer in Hindi. It's like it's very distinctive. It's like from marrow to bone, from bone to flesh, from flesh to skin. The idea is that you're like expelling the sickness from you. It's written in a very particular way. And the exact same prayer is found in Old Norse. So, and this is like the Norse gods all ride around in chariots, but there are no chariots in Scandinavia. So like, how do they even know what chariots are? And the Hindu gods also drive around in chariots. So this is a long way of saying, I just got really interested in these kind of like deep level connective kind of cultural and linguistic.
I was going to say next. It was the next line that you're going to tell me about the aliens and the before times people that were here on the planet before us.
You know, I don't go that far. Like that stuff's all, you know, but I took Latin in high school, and it's crazy. I was looking at Sanskrit, the structure. Well, this is how it was discovered that like, the English went to India. They started studying Sanskrit, and their jaws dropped into their laps because it's very similar to Latin. The structure of Sanskrit is very similar. So the inescapable conclusion is that Sanskrit and Latin are both descended from some lost common language and some lost common culture, and somewhere in the mists of prehistory. And that's kind of how Indo-Europeanism was born. Yeah.
I find it interesting that like history for you seems to kind of come up again and again in the things that you tend to write. Is there a particular reason that that thing is so impactful on you as far as like the type of writing that you like to do?
Yeah, I love the connection between myth and history. I love Dark Ages. It's the age of the Iliad and the Odyssey. You know, this is another thing, like it probably really happened. The events of the Iliad and the Odyssey, it's probably based on some real historical events. Like what happened exactly, we'll never know, but there's a grain of truth there. Similarly, I think The Band of the Crow is inspired by all the legends that came out of the fall of the Roman Empire. Things like King Arthur, there probably was a King Arthur. He's probably an historical person or like a collection of historical people. Sigurd the Dragon Slayer. They're all like real people. I just think that that's amazing. And it's the mystery that's so amazing to me too. I mean, what really happened?
So we were talking about, you know, the history and the interplay in like the storytelling that you choose to do.
Right. So like, yeah. So like yada, 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 Indo-European, you know, ultimately I think the genesis for the story really came in a Mexican restaurant in Times Square in 2005. That is when it all started.
That's a long time ago for the record. It's almost 20 years ago. And
I have been working on the story for like 20 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now is which part of the story, what's taken 20 years? Has it been finding the right other players to make it come, make it happen? Or is the idea behind it just the story itself, you felt that passionate about that it had to be perfect when it came out? Like what lets a person spend 20 years on something, I guess, without like just at some point calling it finished.
I know. No, I ask myself that every, you know, and it's funny because that's how I know I'm on to something. Sort of like with Rex Mundi, if you get challenged and your faith is still strong in a project, that to me, that's a sign that it's the thing that you need to be working on. My belief in the Band of the Crow has never wavered once. I'm even more enthusiastic about it now than I was back at that fateful day in Chevy's Muy Auténtico Ristorante Mexicano in Times Square in 2005. I feel more strongly about it now than I did then. It started as a novel. I thought I was going to get out of writing comics and write a novel. I thought I had a little success writing comics. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say I'm, you know, the biggest, baddest, best deal in comics, but I had a little bit of success and I thought I'd be able to parlay that into a novel, writing a novel. So that's what I did. The Band of the Crow started out as a novel and, you know, it's a fantasy novel. I love world building sort of to a fault. So I spent a lot of time world building on it. So, you know, it's so funny, Nick, you just like you blink, you open your eyes and it's just like 5 years have gone by. And I realized, wow, I've been like, quote unquote, world building for 5 years.
Well, and I also, based on the years that we're talking about, I mean, it's not without worth being mentioned that the landscape changed a lot in the last 20 years as far as like a creative goes. You know, what may have seemed like a reasonable career path or, you know, path to take in 2005, whatever, is very different than what would be a reasonable career path now. Like things that would have been open to you are indelibly closed at this point for no other reason than just your genitals and your skin color, we'll just say.
This is one of the funny things because no one told me this at the time. This, you know, how do you, it's that old sort of cliche about boiling a frog slowly. I didn't really understand it at the time as it was happening. But yeah, I think that this really hateful and regressive and frankly evil ideology just started taking over. I think that this has been a problem for a long time.
Mind you, neither of us consider ourselves conservatives either. So it's the worst part about this.
No, I know it, exactly right. But, you know, I was guilty of demon. Yeah, I contributed to it, too. I think I used to demonize conservatives. I'm not a conservative, but I don't demonize them anymore. I read a lot of conservative news outlets with, you know, along with a lot of liberal news outlets, not to.
Well, I certainly used to pick on them about their slippery slope fallacy all the time. That is proven truer and truer every day into my adulthood.
Right. No, it has a lot of this stuff has come to pass. I mean, it's ugly. So, at any rate, I finally got around to writing the novel and, through my comic book writing, I knew, a literary agent. And she said, no, I won't publish it, but if you work with some editors and get it edited, I'll take another look at it. So this happened. I went to an editor. I met one amazing editor, Benet. It's funny. I haven't spoken to her in a long time. It was really, I learned so much about writing. I learned so much about myself from her. She is one of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life.
Now, so that's interesting because you're saying like you, at this point, you've had success to whatever degree you want to define that. You've had success in writing comics and you're now trying to get into writing novels and there's that much of a jump in like the writing from comics to novels that like you're basically told, well, I can't even look at that. You're going to go find an actual editor for this. Like it's just that much of a different animal.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. And exactly as to what you were saying was true. I didn't realize that this at the time, but if you want to be, you have to pay for and find and seek out an editor yourself now, basically before you go to a literary agent or to a publisher. That is something that the writer has to take upon themselves. They want a fully edited novel that's basically turnkey ready. Because even back then in the day, just the money was just drying up in publishing. Yeah.
And so then, you know, when you know that you're going into this, then the question I always ask is, look, if the thing has to be completely ready by the time I get to you, then what in the hell is the point?
No, exactly right. Exactly right. As I kept doing more stuff, it's just like I'm kind of doing everything on my own here and paying for everything on my own, guys.
When do you start doing stuff? Like, what is the point in that?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, so you're kind of following this trajectory where, and by the way, I do know people who are on professional, you know, are published, you know, traditionally, and they still all tell me the same thing. Yeah, I mean, I do everything occasionally, like, they might make it easier to get certain things done, but I'm still responsible for all of my own marketing. I'm still responsible for making this thing happen for me. So even the guys I know who do TradPub, they're still like, it's a mixed bag of whether or not they at any point are going to go back to just publishing themselves, you know, because once they've kind of got their own name recognition out there, it's really, there's not much point for it at that point.
Exactly. Now I know a bunch of great editors now, with Benet and some other editors. I mean, I worked really, really hard on it, and it was, you know, it's sad because I was done with it. Benet was an intense process, but after like a year of working out with her, she was like, Ovid, I think this novel's fabulous. I'm so impressed with what you've done. I think, and she was not our name dropper. I think she worked with some like pretty famous authors. I never asked because it was just like, it was just a little, she was great. I mean, I think she had an intense client list. In fact, when I approached her, she was just like, Ovid, I'd love to work with you, but I'm not available for the next 18 months. I'm sorry. I was just like, well, screw you then.
Well, if you know anything about like in the book world, that is just like, if I'm dedicating my time to making a book happen, like you just don't have the bandwidth for other stuff, which I'm assuming the longer you spend working on this stuff for yourself and having to deal with the marketing side of things, you realize just how much work goes into like that part of the animal. And I'm constantly coming up with people, you know, they're like, well, like I'll have to quit writing for 6 months just so I can do the marketing stuff for the book, and I don't want to, so I never do. And then, well, if you never do that, then you never achieve what you want to achieve. You're always just kind of writing for what audience, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. This week, like, you know, we're doing this crowdfunding comic book campaign. I spent all this week getting the die ready for the mailing package, the packaging mailer, and the Pantone swatches, and the, you know, the services agreement for this animated trailer that we're making. It's just like, yeah, right, yeah. Right, the amount of time I spend writing is just like, yeah.
The smallest part of what you actually end up having to do for it.
Right. And then, of course, when you sit down and write, you're kind of like, and I don't know what to write. What do I do?
So what, when you think marketing or like having gone through the process that you have, what does marketing mean to you? What does that even exist like?
Yeah, you know, I am so glad that you reached out to me for this because it really forced me to think hard about that question. What I have discovered two things. There are two kinds of marketing strategies, ones that work and ones that don't.
Generally
speaking. And I think a lot of the advice that you get, like what is marketing? I'm still trying to figure that out myself, but basically it means standing out from everybody else. Everyone's fighting for attention. How do you get attention from people? How do you get people, like the opening of The Big Lebowski is one of my favorite film openings of all time. You know, it opens with the thugs dunking Jeff Bridges' head into a toilet. And it's such a great opening because it's just like, whoa.
Those damn nihilists.
Right, those damn nihilists. It really gets your attention. How do you take people's heads and dunk their heads into toilets? That's what marketing is about for me, basically. How do you get people to pay attention to you? How do you get them to stand out from the pack?
Even the pack is an interesting word because it's like you're not just competing against other creators in like your own space. Even it's like you've got to stand out against the feed of constant. I mean, well, just constant politics and socialization that's just constantly pinging them in their brain at all times. That's why like modern marketing, it's, you know, interruption marketing is what it's called. You just interrupt the crap that they're already doing and thinking. That's why, you know, one of the big phrases we use is You want the only real way in is to enter the conversation they're already having.
Right. Wow. I'd never heard that. That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Right. I mean, oh my God, the amount of competition out there. Like you said, right? It's not about, I do firmly believe that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that if one comic succeeds, other comics can succeed.
But you're competing against Trump getting shot at.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And how do you pierce that veil?
Right. No, exactly. So, okay. So here's an example. I've seen people doing this in the independent comics realm. This is a very sad story, but this is just a kind of a pitfall you can have. I was talking to an artist. He developed an Instagram following of like 100,000 followers. Amazing. Amazing. But this is in the didn't work column, unfortunately. And he wrote a very honest Twitter post about this. I really appreciated it. It was honest and it was really refreshing. He had 100,000 Twitter followers, but he gained it by doing drawing. He's a brilliant artist doing drawings of like Batman, Spider-Man, and Thundercats, and He-Man, whatever it might be. So he said that this is what he found it happening. Anytime he did a drawing of one of his original characters, he would lose 100 followers. And anytime he had a call to action, hey, check out my store, check out my website, buy my t-shirts or whatever, he would lose 100 followers every single time and he would get no sales. So in other words, I think the problem he had is that he developed a huge Instagram following, but it wasn't really the following that he needed or wanted to sustain him in making comic books.
His lead magnet wasn't, you know, setting the funnel up for what it needed to be set up for. He's not drawing the right clients. He's drawing people that are interested in something that he's not ultimately trying to sell.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, exactly. It's hard. It sucks. It's heartbreaking, but that just wasn't why they were there. And I think that's another thing that I remember all the time. I'd love to know what your thoughts on this, but I think you just, there's the saying, you have no friends on Wall Street. And I think that they say that's one of the first things that they teach you if one of the first things that they say when you get in the door in like Morgan Stanley or UBS or Goldman Sachs or whatever, they say, look, you have no friends. You have no friends. And just remember that.
I think that's why if you look at my Twitter, I label myself a post corporate marketer. And I think that mentality is something that's been shared by a lot of people for a long time. It's also why no one trusts companies or corporations anymore, because they have lived too long where like it's dog eat dog. We're all trying to screw each other over. And it's just not a sustainable mentality long term. You know, the idea, like, I mean, I'm a capitalist in the sense that like the whole point in capitalism is to offer people value and give them what they want in exchange for value and develop relationships that ultimately are going to help you do that better over time. And if you're constantly screwing each other over, then no one's really getting the value they want, because if I can't expect to work with you in 10 years, well, then, you know, that I'd have to make more decisions down the road for other products because this product's not working out for me. It's just not sustainable. So I see why people say that. And I mean, maybe I'd say like no one cares about you like you do. But look, if we have to go out in the world and we're all constantly fighting at each other's throats, then what kind of world and purpose is any of this anyways, you know?
100%. And yeah, let me just qualify what I was saying. I don't mean with regards to like interpersonal relationships. I mean more like just like you have no friends on Wall Street. It's more like the analogy I'm trying to make is you have no friends in Silicon Valley either. Google is not your friend. Mark Zuckerberg is not your friend. All of these social media companies, you know what I mean? Instagram wants to make people hooked on Instagram. They don't want to help you sell your comic necessarily. I mean, you just need to make sure that those two things are in alignment.
Well, more importantly, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to do what maximizes profit, no matter what that is. Like, that is how our legal structure in America is set up.
And it should be. That's fine. But yet we're just, I think you just have to keep that in mind all times. And to me, that story about that creator with the Instagram following that didn't translate into sales, that's a perfect example of that, in my opinion.
Well, to me, it's when I think of marketing like guitar cables and guitar effects pedals. It's how I always think about it. But it's because I come from the world of music. You know, for me, it's all about my goal is I want to put people in here and have customers out here. And if I'm not getting customers out here, at some point in the signal gathering, this chain of events, something is not doing what it's supposed to be. Something is causing these people to go somewhere else or do something else. It's not connecting. And so the goal is always just to find where the lack of connection is in your system. Now, if you don't have a system of any kind, then you're starting from. Yeah,
that's right.
We have different problems we have to address marketing wise. Like, that's right. We should start by getting you a system.
That's right.
Funnel people in.
Get a speaker, sir. Get a speaker and a mini amp, right? And
well, and the thing is, it's like when you talk about this particular guy, it's interesting to me in that there's something needs tweaked somewhere. That's all it is. Like, clearly the funnel works on getting some people. We just have to get the right people. So what is the thing that we have to put up front there? You know, you call it a lead magnet in a lot of ways. What is the thing that's going to draw people into your world that will translate into? Now, I think he actually probably had a better thing than he thought. 100,000 people follow him on Instagram, and if they drop off, well, that's good, because you don't want to be pitching things constantly to people who aren't interested. It's the people who stick around that you gotta just find that right offer for. Now, it's also, you could be said, like, you have an audience. Do you want to change your pitch and change what you're offering them to match the audience, as opposed to, and maybe that's getting a little too out of the realm of, are we artists or are we, you know, we creating commercial entities, you know, things like that.
Right, right. I mean, artists or rip-off artistes. Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, like, people are like, I don't want to speak ill of anyone who makes a choice that, you know, commerce is how we put things on the table, you know, so perhaps in some ways it's better to chase commerce. I've always joked that if Britney Spears came and asked me to play spoons in Britney Spears' band, I'm absolutely going to do it. I'd want to drill my teeth out the whole time I'm doing it. But with all that money I make doing that, I could absolutely go build my own studio and make all the art that I want to make for me. And no one else ever even has to see it if I don't want to. So, you know, where does commercialism step into, you know, the art, and how much can you take and stomach as an artist, that kind of thing? Like, that's why, even in music, I've always considered myself more of a performer than perhaps a writer. Not that I don't write, but it's like, I really enjoy the element of performing. So even if you give me somebody else's stuff, I'm going to have a blast bringing it to life. But when it comes to people that are, you know, just writers, there is certainly a difference of opinion in that world usually. Well, I'm curious if there's anything else you'd like to get out to the audience. Certainly tell them the Kickstarter, where we can send them to for that.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. I can tell you a few things that did work too. I mean, it's not all doom and gloom. It's not all doom and gloom. I think one of the best things that we did for Rex Mundi is we were religious about this. We were ultra hyper scrupulous about this. We did a web comic, and this is back in like 2000. The web comics are very different now, obviously, but we were basically syndicated. I don't know what you want to call it, but we were on like 10 different web comic sites, and every Friday we'd put up a new one. We spent like 2 years doing this. I mean, we spent a huge amount of time doing this, and you know, it was a free web comic, and it was great. Every week, it was called Brother Matthew. It was kind of like a spinoff. We did like a Rex Mundi spinoff before Brother Matthew had a little cameo in Rex Mundi, but every week it was great because we had something to talk about, and it wasn't really spam. It was just, I put a webcomic out. I'm not charging you for it, so you can't really call it spam. I just want you to read it. I just want you to, like, what did you called it? A lead-in or
lead magnet.
A lead magnet. That's exactly what it was. It was a lead magnet for us. And it worked really, really well for us with Rex Mundi. I'll never, one of my, oh, sorry, please.
Well, no, it's actually funny. This is something I wanted to bring up that I've heard it a couple times this week where someone's like, oh, well, I'm not in that cycle, in the marketing part of my cycle. And I think that I personally think that that's a mistake for anyone who's creating to look at, because if you're waiting until like you're done with the book to worry about marketing, you've already lost. Like, there's plenty of time for you to be building your network, building your audience before the thing was ever even done. And if people go a year, 2 years, 3 years, even 6 months without hearing from you in some form or fashion, you don't exist in their world anymore. There's just too much crap to fill it up with. You know, that's why, you know, email marketing and sending regular emails, I think, is super important. But that's why a lot of these creators are going the webcomic route, because sure, I can get you hooked where I'm constantly, you get that steady drip of content, you build the, it's why, it's one of the things that was lost in the comic book industry was, you know, Wednesday, going picking up your pull box. When that stopped being a thing that people did, well, they lost the habit. So, you know, one of the things I hear is becoming, you know, the norm is that you put out these web comics and it's building that habit again in people in the digital realm. You know, and yeah, you're not going to get everyone to go and buy your comic, but the people that really love it will. And you're getting a better qualified lead at that point. You're getting someone who just is a diehard. You don't have to sell at that point. Like, they're there. They want more of what you have. So, and it's just interesting to me in that, like, the stuff that like seems so obvious, I think. It's like, oh, well, why am I making all this stuff for free? And it's like, well, you're doing it because no one knows who you are. And they at least put it someplace where people are looking for comics, you know?
That's right. Yeah, exactly right. So, that was 2 years of our life. We pretty much did nothing. It was we put a lot of effort into it. So that was 2 years. Pretty much that's all we did was do that webcomic like for free. But the payoff was, I will never forget it, one of the happiest moments in my life. I was living in New York City and Rex Mundi had just come out. And Image, they originally published it kind of on a let's see how this goes basis. Like, yeah, if sales are strong, we'll make it an ongoing series, but no promises. So it was like 2 a.m. I was just coming out of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, kind of in like Greenwich Village in New York City. And The Forbidden Planet's a great comic book, one of the great comic book stores. It was open, of course. So I went in to check on Rex Mundi, see what I was doing, and I couldn't find it. I was just like, what? Because I talked to Jeff, the buyer there. Like, I said, hey, I'm Marvin, I got a comic, blah, blah, blah. So Jeff was there. I was just like, Jeff, what happened? I thought you were gonna carry Rex Mundi. I don't see it. And he said, yeah, I can't get any copies of it. And I said, what do you mean? You can't? I was just, oh my God, there was a mistake. Like, there's a problem at the warehouse. Was it all turned into toilet paper? What happened? He said, no, Arvid, you don't understand. I can't get any more copies. It sold out. It sold out, Arvid. Congratulations.
Success like, problems.
Right, exactly. I was just like, oh. I was doing like, you know, clicking my heels like a leprechaun all the way back home. So it was worth it. I mean, it was worth it. That's the point I'm trying to make. It was, I firmly believe that it was that webcomic that led to that success. So, yeah, just like you said, yeah, you have to do it for free. Uh-huh.
Well, keep, it's a way to keep front and center in the consciousness of people. I mean, and there's also certain like elements of, you know, if you do something for somebody, then they feel like they owe you. So you give away enough free stuff, eventually, like that's what is it? It's what's the Hare Krishnas? That's why they hand out flowers at airports.
Stories. That's right,
because
the norm of reciprocity. Yeah.
Yep. And you feel like you have to do something to level the cosmic equation.
No, it's very powerful. It's cross cultural too, like Africa, Asia, Europe, South America. Doesn't matter. It's very, very powerful human instinct. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm curious, is there something else that you think you feel real strongly is, you know, has worked for you in the past as far as marketing goes?
Yeah, a few other things have worked here. I had a list up. What are some of the other things? Being published at Image Comics was great. Brand name recognition matters. We got a lot more attention from journalists. This is back. Comics journalism is just, oh my God. It is such an SHIT show now. It's all completely colonized by social justice. But it didn't use, it's so sad, these sites that I used to really, a lot of sites that really supported me, now that probably wouldn't talk to me anymore. But anyway, I'm just sort of fetching now. Being able to say, hey, I'm Arvid and I have a comic coming out from Image is very different from, hey, I'm Arvid and I have a comic. Those are two very, very different statements.
Well, I mean, if I were to hear, hi, I'm Arvid and I have a comic coming out from Image now, I'm going to have to go, oof.
Right. No, right. Right. Hey.
Is that worth reading? Yeah. Do I think? I don't know.
Yeah. As you know, there's still, Image is still doing great stuff, of course, too. But yeah.
I mean, I joke because most of my pull list is still Image comics, but.
No, but I'm with you, Nick. I mean, yeah, I mean, some of that stuff is just like, I'm with you. I know it's sad, but isn't that just what we're talking about? It's like once you damage your brand identity, it's very hard to repair it. Very, very hard.
I couldn't tell you the last Marvel anything I've picked up. DC, I usually only pick up the Black Label stuff. Or occasionally, like, they've got, like, the Sandman Universe stuff I'll pick up because it's usually darker stuff. But it's Boom Studios and Image across the board for the rest of my pull list.
Yeah. So, so brand recognition helps. The number one thing that helped, and this is just kind of the grim reality of it, this is up, like, way more than anything else, was just the fact that Johnny Depp was interested in a Rex Mundi movie for a long time. He was a producer on it. Once that word got out, that was a huge, 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 huge boost to the comics. So, I mean,
I'm out of curiosity, how does that happen? Like, someone pitch it to him? Is he like an actual, just a ground level fan of the series? Like, I'm just curious.
Yeah. So what happens is we were at comic book conventions. We know Eric the artist lived in San Diego, so we would go to the San Diego Comic Book Convention. My understanding is that comics publishers are actually pulling out of comic book conventions, and they're I think last I heard that they're not even going to be at San Diego this year. But at any rate, back then, it may still be that way. There are lots of producers and people in Hollywood who are sort of prowling around the convention floor. So the first year we were doing our thing with our Rex Mundi table. Barry Levine gave us our card. He gave us his card. And we just started talking with him. And Barry's a phenomenally energetic person. I have a lot of affection for him. And he did a lot of legwork. So sort of by hook or by crook, somehow working behind the scenes. I don't even know the amount of work that he put in. But he, I think, with some other producers, had a connection with Johnny Depp's production company. So I think that's how he got his hands on it. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So
right on.
So that was that.
Well, I think we've got some stuff in here for people to mull their heads around. where can I send people for your current project?
Yeah, thanks. We're going to be announcing our mailing list soon. It's kind of semi-officially up. I'll give you a link if you don't mind putting it up in the interview links.
You give me a link and it will absolutely go at the bottom of the screen when I put it up.
Great, thank you. There's that, and basically I'm on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter as much as I am as I should be, but to the extent that I'm online, probably next month once our mailing list goes live, I'll be much more active. But you can find me on Twitter. I am Arvid the Twit on Twitter. So that's how you find me. At Arvid the Twitch.
Right on. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on, talking to my audience today, Arvid. We definitely crossed some things that I think needed to be discussed for people. And some other things that just need to be drilled in until they can recite it in their sleep.
Yeah. Amen. Thank you, Nikki. Again, appreciate what you do. I've seen the difference that marketing makes. It's important. Yeah.
Well, I hopefully more people figure out how they can do it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, uh-huh.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironagemarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.